There knelt Joseph, a little round mound, beside the dwarf called Shepsis Bess, on the paving of the court, and peered curiously through his fingers at the priceless, utterly unknown presence which swayed past him in its gilded chair, adorned with lions' heads, only a few paces away. This underworldly product of culture, civilization's height, roused in him no other feeling than a respect strongly tinged with critical disapproval. No other thought than perhaps something like, "Aha, that must be the mistress, Potiphar's wife, who is supposed to tremble for his safety. Where does she belong? Is she friend or foe? One cannot tell from her looks. A very great Egyptian lady. My father would disapprove of her. I am more lenient in my judgment. On the other hand, I am not to be dazzled." That was all, and on her side it was still less. As she swayed past, she turned her jewel-crowned head for a second to the place where they did reverence. She saw them and saw them not, so idle and unseeing was her glance. She probably recognized the dwarf, for she knew him. Perhaps the faintest shadow of a smile showed in her enamel-lengthened eyes and just deepened the corners of her sinuous mouth. Even that is doubtful. The other figure she did not know, and scarcely noticed it. He looked a little odd because of the faded cloak the Ishmaelites had given him, and also his hair had not an Egyptian cut. Did she see it? She must have done so. But he could scarcely have penetrated her lofty consciousness. If he did not belong here, the gods knew where he did belong, and that was quite enough. She, Mut Emenet, called Enni, thought far too much of herself to consider the question. Did she see how beautiful and well-favored he was? Why ask? Her seeing was no seeing. She never thought, it was hidden from her, that here was any occasion for the use of her eyes. Not the shadow of a suspicion visited either of what was to happen, whither a few years was to bring them both, that the reverential little bundle over there on the ground was one day to be her one and all, her ecstasy and anguish, the single morbid content of her mind, which should distract its sense, make her commit mad acts of folly, destroy all the dignity, self-control, and order of her days. The woman dreamt not of it. What tears she would bring him to, with what uttermost danger she threatened his brideship of God and the garland of his head, that through her folly he would come in peril of losing his God. All this the dreamer could not dream, though the sight of her lily arm hanging down from her chair might have given him to think. The onlooker, knowing the tale as it fell out in all its hours, may be forgiven if he pauses a little, shaking his head, and assumes the ignorance of those who are in the story and not outside it. He puts aside the indiscretion which made him lift the curtain of the future, and confines himself to the hour of the reigning feast, which lasted 7 years, the years of Joseph's incredible rise in the house of Petipre. From that moment, when, after the litter had swayed past them, the fool Bes-em-heb whispered to Joseph there in the court, "We must cut your hair and dress you as others are dressed," and led him to the barber in the servants' quarters, who, jesting the while with Bes-em-heb, cut Joseph's hair in the Egyptian fashion, so that he looked like the wayfarers along the canals. Thence they took him to the wardrobe room, where the apron skirts were kept, and issued to him Egyptian clothing out of the stores, the livery of Petipre for best and for common wear, so that at last he looked like a child of Kempt, and even his brothers at first glance might not have known him. These 7 years, then, were a repetition and imitation of the father's life in the life of the son, corresponding to the period in which Jacob turned from a landless fugitive to a man weighed down with possessions and an indispensable partner in Laban's enterprises, which by the power of the blessing were swollen with prosperity. Now it was Joseph's turn to make himself indispensable. And how did he do it? Did he find water as Jacob did? It would have been utterly superfluous. There was abundance of water on Petipre's estate, not only in the lotus pond and the pleasure garden, but also in square basins sunk in the ground among the orchards and vegetable gardens. They had no connection with the nourisher, but supplied the estate from subsoil sources. No, there was no need of water, nor of domestic well-being of any kind. For if Potiphar's house was not a house of blessing, and indeed it proved, despite all its dignity, to be rather a house of tribulation than folly, yet it abounded in material prosperity, to an extent which made it well-nigh impossible for anybody to give it increase, or to play the role of blessing-bringer in any such sense. It must suffice that the owner should one day come to the conviction that if he put his affairs into this young stranger's hands, all would be well, and himself not need to trouble further, or act otherwise than befitted his lordly station and ways, so that the blessing displayed itself above all in the establishment of trust, and Joseph's natural dislike of betraying such confidence in any point, above all in the most personal and delicate, was to prove to the blessing-bearer a mighty bulwark against betraying his compact with God. Yes, this was Joseph's Laban time. Yet there were great material differences, and things fell out quite otherwise for the son, for in repetition there is always change. As in the kaleidoscope, the bits of colored glass shape ever different patterns. Life, in its play, produces changing patterns out of the same material, and the constellation of the sun, formed of the same little glass splinters as the father's, yet showed a new form. The parallel of the kaleidoscope is instructive. For in how much richer, more involved and varied patterns did the son's life shape itself? He is a later, more difficult and dangerous case, this Joseph, a son probably cleverer and flightier than the father, yet more interesting, difficult, painfuler. Scarcely even is the pattern of the father's life recognizable in that of the son who repeats it. How much richer it is, how much more complex, more dangerous. Where, for instance, is the figure and concept of Rachel, that pure and classic fundamental? And what extraordinary and hazardous arabesque instead? Of course, we see what is coming, what is already present, because it happened when the story first told itself, and is only not yet come to pass because we give due heed to later introduced laws of time and sequence. It exerts a powerful, uncanny fascination. Our lively curiosity, of a peculiar kind indeed, since it already knows and interests itself only in the telling, tempts us ever and anon to anticipate the hour. Thus the double sense of the once upon a time practices its magic upon us. Future is past, and what happened long ago now plays itself out again in the clear-cut present.